Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the webinar on overhaul of Indian contract enforcement regime. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you and welcome all the participants on this webinar, which we have specifically organized to discuss the recent amendments to the Specific Relief Act, which were passed in the Parliament and assented by the President in August. It came into force very recently on October 1, 2018. So as Nishit Desai Associates, we thought that this is one of the most important developments which needs some level of discussion and interaction, because this is going to change the landscape of contract enforcement as we go along in terms of jurisprudence and in terms of adjudication of commercial disputes. So as we know, this government, since it came into power in 2014, has come up with several different amendments, including amendments to the arbitration law, brought in the whole new regime of insolvency code in terms of recovery and, you know, enforcement of creditor rights and so on and so forth. I think as part of, you know, the measure to bring in the aspect of doing business in India index more favorable to India, I think this is another very significant step which was possibly coming in their way to tell to the world that yes, we enforce our contracts. I think what was there in the earlier regime was, of course, as well for enforcing the contract, but it is more of an exceptional remedy than a general remedy. So a lot has changed as part of this amendment. So we thought this would be an apt topic to discuss in this webinar. We are very, very privileged because we are joined today on this webinar by Professor Nilima Bhadbhade. As many of you know, she has been teaching contract law, insurance, evidence and property law at ILS Law College, Pune. She was also one of the members of the expert committee which was set up to suggest and recommend what needs to change under the Specific Relief Act. And the report was submitted to the government in 2016, which was the basis of this amendment itself. So we have somebody who has some insights as part of the committee itself. And we all have read, you know, her books on contract law and specific performance, which are in a way led to even government thinking about what are the issues which needs to be addressed under this law. So we are very, very privileged again to have you, Nilima, and welcome to this
Thank
webinar.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
We are also joined by Simone Rees. She leads our M&A and private equity investment practice at NDA, and also with our senior member of our litigation and dispute resolution practice at Delhi, Ashish Chandra. So he has also joined on video over this webinar. And at the end of the webinar, we'll also release the full transcript and video of this, so people who may you know, miss this webinar or may want to go through this webinar later, will be you know, we'll be happy to provide the video as well, which would be available on our knowledge site, www.nishitdesai.com. So with that introduction, let me straight away start the discussions with Ashish, has also done some analysis and research on this subject. So maybe, Ashish, can you spend a little time and give a very, very broad overview as to what amendments have come in and what was there earlier so that you can then take the discussion forward?
Sure. Thank you, Vyapak. So obviously, there are a number of key changes which have been introduced now with this Amendment Act. Broadly, there are five major changes which we see. The first two sort of relate to the interplay between the relief of compensation and specific performance. And sort of there are three broad key takeaways which we see from the amendments. First is that damages is no longer a principal remedy. Second is that discretion with the courts in grant of specific performance has been taken away. And third, it is now, or it is the choice of the promisee to choose between compensation or specific performance. So the first two sort of changes come in, as you see, from section and amendments to section 10, 11, 14, and 16. The first of which is to say that adequacy of compensation or ascertainability of compensation in case of non-performance as a ground for refusal of specific performance has been removed. So obviously, in such cases, parties can now also go ahead and claim specific performance, and therefore damages no longer remains the principal remedy. The second sort of change over here is the grounds on which the specific performance can be refused. So section 14 and section 20 deals with the grounds on which specific performance will be refused, or where of how the court may exercise its discretion while granting specific performance. So one, two main grounds that we see which have directly been removed for refusing specific performance. One is where the contract runs in such minute details that the performance of which cannot be, material terms cannot be specifically enforced, or otherwise the contract itself is of such nature that the performance of its material terms cannot be specifically enforced. And again, Section 20, which was there in the erstwhile regime, provided for instances or areas where court may exercise discretion for not granting specific performance, and these specifically included situations of hardship, inequitability, or unfair advantage. And if the court perceives such kind of circumstances from being arising, the court could have exercised discretion and removed or not granted specific performance. So the first two changes sort of relate, or the first two broad changes relate with the discretion and the interplay of relief between specific performance and compensation. Third is now the introduction of an express provision regarding the availability of substituted performance. So the parties can now go and, in the event of a promisee who suffers, who is now facing not perform his promise, can now go to a third party, seek or have that promise performed through a third party, and actually recover the cost which is incurred through the which is incurred in making the contract performed by a third party, along with any other damages in form of compensation that it incurs in this process. So this is another major change. Fourth change that we see is an express provision which relates to inclusion of ability of the courts to actually go and engage experts to assist them during trials and in suits. Earlier, there was no such express provision. The Evidence Act had under a section given a provision where courts could engage experts in relation to matters of science and such. But that provision did not really give out an express carve-out in terms of procedure that the court can go and then ask for an appointment of expert. Similarly, Order 16, Rule 14 also provides the ability to court to call any person as a witness. But again, this provision was very sparingly used and mostly used in cases of obtaining fact witnesses, which is not something an expert will come to. So now express provision has been included, which will probably lead to sort of court exercising more power and this and engaging experts more frequently to assist them during these suits and trials. And one of the last and the most significant changes that we have now seen relates to infrastructure projects. Obviously, with this government, we have seen, as you were highlighting earlier, there's also a strong focus on improving the speed at which infrastructure projects are completed. And one of the key impediments which were seen were the legal hurdles and the injunctions which were being granted by courts for completion of infrastructure projects. To remove such hurdle and with that objective in mind, three main provisions have been also now been introduced. First, it says that suits which relate to contracts in relation to contract involving relating to an infrastructure project, the court will not grant an injunction which will cause an impediment or delay in the completion of that infrastructure project. Second, it has sort of now said that a special courts will be set up to deal with such cases. And third, it has imposed a timeline of 12 months for completion of such cases. Obviously, in terms of timeline and setting up, of course, we have seen what has happened in the case of other such enactments, such as the Commercial Courts Act, where the courts were indeed set up quickly, but the timelines have not always been adhered to. So possibly we may see a similar kind of effect in relation to these provisions. Obviously, there are other changes which have also been made, which also have an impact. But broadly speaking, these are the five main changes which have been introduced through this amendment.
Sure. Thanks, Ashish. So if I may go to Nilima now, and as we see, I think the major changes under the Act, where Section 10 and Section 14 are completely overhauled. So to say, 10, which talks about the certain kinds of contracts which are enforceable and 14 which are not enforceable, I think 10 has completely been eliminated subject to new Section 14. And to say that now the shift is that enforcement is more of a general remedy than an exception under the Indian law. Can we now go ahead and tell the world very confidently that yes, everything that you bargained for, you will have to enforce in India? Or is there still some way out the way the new law, you know, reads?
Thank you very much. It is my privilege to be speaking during this webinar and discussing it on questions which will be posed later. The change in the current law is a drastic change in the law relating to specific performance. Before the amendment, specific performance was an exceptional remedy, and the plaintiff who wanted to ask for it was required to show either the compensation was inadequate or it was unascertainable, which I call the test of inadequacy. Now, a person who wishes to approach the court is not sure whether his contract will be seen as satisfying this inadequacy test. So here lies an uncertainty. Whenever there's an uncertainty in relation to contract, it is difficult for parties, number one, to be sure whether the other party will willingly perform it, because remedies are uncertain. And second, when he approaches the court, whether he will get that remedy which he asks or not. Moreover, it is difficult even for lawyers to advise clients which remedy they will be able to get, because grant of remedy is dependent on circumstances. Now, the purpose of this amendment, which now makes available specific performance as a remedy if the plaintiff chooses. What is the change? The change is that the exceptional nature of the remedy has been taken away. And now any person who wishes to ask for specific performance is able to ask for it. There is no initial hurdle of the inadequacy test. The purpose of this main change in the law is to promote the ease of doing business. Business becomes easy when there is faith in contracting. And there is faith in contracting when people will be willing more to perform and when breach is discouraged. So these two things we know, the willingness and the encouragement to breach, are very dependent on the type of remedies which a law provides. All those who advise on contracts or commercial transactions give their advice dependent on the enforcement scene and the remedies which are available to us. And when the remedy is uncertain, it is uncertain for the plaintiff to ask for the remedy, and it is so much easier for the breaking party to break the contract. If the remedial structure enables or encourages performance, it increases faith in contract, and that increases faith in business. So, specific performance is available for anyone who wants. The uncertainty goes away, and that, I suppose, will encourage parties to perform and discourage them from breach. The question is, how is this uncertainty removed? There is another factor to this uncertainty. One was, of course, its exceptional nature. The other is the discretion of the court in granting or refusing the relief, which came under Section 20 of the Pre-Amendment Act of 1963. So, the discretion lay in refusing specific performance if there was, and as was stated earlier, unfair advantage to the plaintiff, undue hardship to the defendant, or it is otherwise inequitable to specifically enforce the contract. Now, these three factors are no longer available for refusing specific performance. It is under these provisions that court refused to enforce contracts when there was a delay or when during the course of the litigation prices rose. The problem is not that discretion was exercised, but the problem, or rather the uncertainty, arises because different judges, different judgments at different times interpreted this discretion for similar set of facts in different ways. So where one judge said rise in prices should be compensated, another judge or another court with other judges said that rise in prices should not affect. This sort of uncertainty gets removed when discretion is removed. So in these two ways, the law has changed and made specific performance a general remedy, and the uncertainty has been removed. The objective now is that let the plaintiff decide which remedy he wants. If he wants specific performance, let him ask for it. If he is willing to wait, he will ask. Is it true that many more suits of specific performance will be filed? I do not think so, because only that person will ask for specific performance who is willing to wait and who thinks that he will be able to force the other party to perform. And if he is confident of that, he will ask for specific performance. So the whole purpose is, why should the law decide? Why not the plaintiff decide the remedies? And that is what actually this amendment now seeks to achieve. So now this has become a general remedy, and the exceptional nature and the discretion has been taken away. But is this something very new in law? Now we have legal systems of two types. One is where specific performance and injunction in relation to contracts are exceptional and discretionary. And this is so in most common law jurisdictions. And where specific performance is available to the plaintiff who wants, which is the law in many civil jurisdictions, and even now it is available as a remedy in so many conventions. So we have these two systems. We have shifted from one system to the other system.
I think two or three takeaways, the way I look at it. One, there is a shift from the general understanding of common law principles of discretion of the court on granting specific performance, which is now taken away. Two, it is for the promisee or the person who has suffered the breach, he has or she has, it has to decide as to what is required, whether specific performance is still necessary or compensation is what the person wants. And therefore, I think it will be now a big onus before you choose a remedy as to whether you want to go for specific performance or you still want to look for compensation. Because once you choose the path, I think it would be possibly difficult to, you know, come back. I think that's the second takeaway. And the third point is that now I think the threat that you can still go ahead and specifically perform whatever you have bargained for may reduce the attitude or the mindset of, you know, breaching contracts, thinking that it is something that they can live with, because compensation is not easy to ascertain and specific performance is not a norm. So I think, in my view, the third and the most important takeaway is that before breaching the contract, I think the person would think twice because they can be forced to specifically perform. Taking this point a little further, does this mean that everything is enforceable, or there is still some amount of, if I may not use the word discretion, but at least law available as to what cannot be enforced? And two, by putting that section 14 as to what cannot be enforced, has the law achieved its right balance, taking care of both the promisor and promisee, or something more is still to be done as part of bringing that balance?
If we look at the scheme of the law relating to specific performance, it's divided usually into four parts. One is under the old law. One is for which contracts you can ask specific performance, but then some of those contracts will not be specifically enforced, which is section 14. So the first is 10, then is 14. Then there are personal bars to relief which come under 16, that the person should be ready and willing, etc. This part of the law has not changed much. And lastly, even if all these are fulfilled, there is still a discretion vested in the court not to grant it. So there are these four elements in the grant of specific performance under the pre-amendment law. Now I deal with the question of section 14. Section 14, the principle behind it is that the court should effectively be able to enforce its orders until the order is effectively executed. Here we are on the point of execution of an order of the court. What is meant by execution? Whatever the court has ordered should be achieved using the powers of the court. That is in the execution proceedings, under 21 these various remedies, and it should be executable under them. But even more important than that is that all this execution after the order has been passed should satisfy the promisee that this is exactly what he has asked. So this is balancing two things. Number one, the court being able to enforce what it has ordered, and this enforcement, does it give the plaintiff what he wanted? And it is this that section 14 deals with. So section 14 is about practicality of enforcement. It is about effective enforcement. It has to do on the one hand with maintaining dignity of courts, because courts can't enforce their own orders. This is not a good state of affairs. So court's dignity must be upheld, and it will pass only those orders which it will be able to enforce. Second is the question of cost. Costs for compelling somebody to do something, they say, are much higher. Unfortunately, there is no economic analysis of what is the cost of a particular type of suit. But it is universally, I mean, academicians have argued that it costs more to enforce a specific performance degree than compensation. And this element of cost, therefore, must be reduced. And the third is that the order should not create fresh controversies. One of the elements is that that performance which requires continuous duty will not be enforced. Why? Because let us suppose the first order is enforced, again there is a dispute, then again you need one more order, then again there is a dispute, then there is a dispute about interpretation of order. So this continuous dispute should not arise. So these are the concerns relating to effective enforcement, and section 14 deals with them. Therefore, under the amended provision, a contract which is terminable is known, it is useless to enforce it, and therefore it should not be enforced. Then a contract which involves continuous duty will not be enforced, because the court will be called upon to pass orders or to decide whether the enforcement is correct and according to the contract or not. And the third one,
on personal qualifications.
Those contracts which are based on personal qualifications cannot be enforced, because what the promisor does personally may not satisfy the promisee fully. So these have been retained as they were under the existing Act. There are two of them which have been removed. One of them is that a contract which runs into minute or numerous details, the court should not enforce, which has been removed. But anyway, if it involves continuous duty, the court may still decide not to enforce it. However, a very important deletion is of these words. Section 14 originally said that if the contract is such, and I quote, otherwise from its nature such that the court cannot enforce specific performance of its material terms. Unquote. This part of Section 14 was a very essential part. Let me take an example. There's a contract where the terms are uncertain because you cannot formulate them into a precise language of the decree. But they are certain enough to award compensation. For example, A has agreed with B that this is a contract for sale of usual goods. What does this usual mean? While granting compensation, the court is able to decide. But when it is formulating the decree, what sort of goods will it write in the decree which is to be enforced? So, it is a contract where the terms are not as certain as they can be incorporated into a decree. This is a type of contract which the court will not be able to enforce even if it wants, but it should be able to grant compensation. So, such types of situations are dealt with under this terminology. Otherwise, from its nature, it is such that specific performance cannot be enforced. And the deletion of this part will some cases they will put questions before a judge as to whether specific performance can be refused or it cannot be refused. Now, there is one part which is not incorporated in 14. Universally, in all countries, including those where specific performance is a general remedy, including in the convention, specific performance is refused where substitutes are available to the plaintiff. The idea is that the plaintiff should complete the performance of his, get the performance of his promise completed on his own rather than approach the court for specific performance. This exception, which is found in most systems and which was there, so to say, in clause A of section 14 earlier, is missing in the
sure.
This is where law is going to differ with almost the laws of all countries relating to specific performance.
I think the more and more we hear what has happened as part of these amendments in section 10, 14, a bit of 16, and a large part of 20, is that the discretion from the court is taken away. But a lot of this discretion is given to the party. So yes. If you think that this is something which, if you ask for specific performance, you will be at a loss rather than at a gain, then I think somebody has to advise the party not to go for specific performance and just claim for compensation. And therefore, I think the idea about the amendments looks like that let the party decide what he chooses for himself rather than giving the discretion to the court, because then the discretion is used discretionary rather than in a pattern which somebody can predict, and that brings a lot of uncertainty. So I think that may be the basis why possibly the amendments to 14 takes away a lot of sections which are not specific in terms of predictability as to what cannot be enforced. I think what has happened is only things which are predictable are not enforced, and everything else it is for the party to decide as to what they want to do in terms of the enforcement versus going for compensation. So let me shift a little bit of the discussion from a theoretical or a jurisprudence issues from a litigation perspective to a transactional perspective. And we have Simon, who has been doing a lot of transactions for more than a decade now. And these issues keep coming up in negotiations. In a simple share purchase agreement, can this be enforced or it is just you can keep writing, you know, several pages on what will happen in terms of closings, in terms of enforcing the share purchase agreement. At the end of the day, when you go to court, you possibly can't do anything except look for some compensation, but you don't get the shares. And it's not easy to look for compensation because when you are doing a commercial transaction which has a longer term benefits or a longer-term vision, or it has several other aspects weaved into a specific contract, it's not easy to determine a loss, and therefore you are not compensated fully. So how does this change? Does this make contracting easy? Does this raise more questions, or this at least allows you to tell the client that, look, don't worry, if you want specific performance, you will get it. So take it as of now, and then choose at the end of the period or at the time of breach as to what you want. What do you see as a transaction lawyer?
So, Vyapak, let me take this in terms of the contracts that we deal with on an everyday basis with our clients. And I will first start with discussion on investment agreements, especially with respect to shareholder agreements. Now, there's been, you know, a lot of concern or issue, especially by investors, as to how strong their contracts really are and whether rights that have been agreed to and are bespoke to that investor are rights that will actually see the light of day and be enforced or not. Let's just talk about the simple drag-along right. Now, in a shareholder's agreement, investors like to have something called a drag-along right, which enables them, should all other exit options fail, to be able to drag the promoter shareholder and deliver to a buyer a full majority of the company. Now, it is often sort of questioned as to whether this drag-along right is actually something that is enforceable, will be specifically enforced by a court or not. And I see this law really coming to the rescue of most private equity investors and also most transactional lawyers that have actually discussed and deliberated as to in what circumstances these rights should come and be given effect to. Now you have, on the other hand, promoters or shareholders that are capable of being dragged, often using or agreeing to rights on day one and wriggling out of fulfilling their obligations, you know, on day two. And perhaps we will see a much stronger enforcement or these rights being more cautiously negotiated now and henceforth, because the ability to specifically enforce that contract is that more stark. Now, as we discussed, the grounds for relief for not granting specific performance, especially matters like undue hardship caused to the defendant, have been removed from the concept of, or have been removed from the provisions of the specific relief act. So therefore, saying that this would, that I could compensate you in another way, because this drag-along right, for instance, will cause undue hardship for me, may not be a justification that will work going forward. So, to my mind, these amendments do grant the investor or contracting party who has put in money in an Indian in any company the ability to see their rights actually being enforced going forward. Now, having said that, I think there are matters to be looked at specifically as to how drafting styles are adopted and how you ensure that, you know, there is clarity of thought with respect to how the contract needs to work. As we discussed earlier, if things are not clear and a court cannot really give effect to the contract as was agreed by the parties, perhaps things may be a different light, and the benefits of the amendments to the Specific Relief Act would not be seen by the plaintiff. So therefore, clearly drafted clauses and good sequencing of events is extremely important, given that this now will become an important remedy going forward. Matters like or clauses which begin with subject to applicable law may actually pose a difficulty, really, in enforcing, specifically because one can argue that the enforcement of that contract was only if certain parameters were met. Therefore, you know, how you draft this clause and what are the conditions to actually performing that contract is extremely important. Now, we did talk about, you know, share purchase agreements, and sort of I will come to that now. Now, whilst In a shareholder's agreement, it is prospective. A share purchase agreement actually requires you to take an asset that already exists. And very often, purchasers sort of relied on representations and warranties to ensure that the asset was free of all encumbrances and so on and so forth. Now you have a situation where you have an asset and you are technically a bona fide purchaser. But remember that the specific relief act can be enforced not just by you who's bought the asset, but somebody that has a prior claim. And therefore, in that context, you would have to ensure that the specific relief act doesn't really give you or release an opportunity from you to have defenses like bona fide purchasers and so on and so forth taken away from you, because that asset can also be claimed by somebody else through a specific relief remedy. Yeah, and you may not have much defense there. So it does work both ways. I think especially in investment agreements, perhaps you will see new kinds of costs by parties. Perhaps things like termination fees would be something that is insisted upon now, because you have the ability to specifically enforce that if parties do not fail to fulfill the terms of the contract one way or the other. You may actually specifically demand an amount to be paid, and given the benefits of the amendments specifically, that may well be a good sort of remedy against a breaching party. So, you know, time will tell, of course, but I think more and more the benefits of the specific relief act, or specifically enforcing a contract as opposed to having parties discourage performance, and the attitude of the performing party will definitely undergo change, given that this becomes more credible now.
Sure. So I think in terms of M&A deals, joint ventures, investment agreements, and share purchases, a lot possibly will change in terms of drafting your termination clauses, because that will also go back to the issue of Section 14. A lot will change in terms of your compensation or liquidated damages clauses, because you no longer have to write that this is not adequate or it's not an alternate to the specific performance. So a lot of the boilerplate clauses possibly will also change. And it is not something that lawyer would be worried about, that okay, break fee is the only option and not the enforcement, and therefore contracting will become more certain in terms of you know, this kind of contracts. But I think apart from this kind of commercial contracts involving you know, long term joint ventures or M&As and you know, indemnity flowing through it, I think there are also, you know, thousands of contracts that executed day in and day out for simple scale purchase of goods, services, a lot of infrastructure, or contracts which are related to a larger project, may or may not be infrastructure, but which are important, that not a single chain in a series of contracts get, you know, get into a trouble and not get enforced. Otherwise, the whole project or the whole ecosystem around a lot of business gets, you know, prejudiced. So I think a lot has been talked about in terms of the new provision of substituted performance of contracts. There has been a discussion whether this is the perfect remedy out, because you don't have to then wait for specific performance as part of the court remedy, but at least you take your contract, move on with a substituted performance with a third party, and then only thing you have to possibly worry is to recover that cost. At least this is now a matter of right rather than a simple risk mitigation strategy. So Ashish, is this an important change? Will this make contract enforcement even more relevant, because then you can simply go ahead and do a substituted performance and you don't have to worry about the compensation, but just claim the cost and of course additional compensation if that's all there is a loss of part of the performance.
Yes, Vyapak. So if you see the law earlier, like one may say, there's always been the case that substituted performance has been something just always the law has contemplated. For example, the simple sale purchase agreement for supply of coal. If somebody fails to deliver, you always had the option to obtain that coal from some other source and then claim the difference in terms of compensation. So as such, you could have always, in effect, have had a substituted performance and recovered the balance. But what essentially does this new relief of substituted performance bring in? What exactly is the change here? So the change principally consists in two ways. One is more of a cultural change, where focus is that the contract gets performed, because in other circumstances you could have substituted a claim to compensation on the basis of assumed performance in that sense. But the main change which is actually coming in is in terms of how do the principles of mitigation of loss or foreseeability of damages play out when put in the context of simple compensation or when put in the context of substituted performance. So in substituted performance, because of the fact that a party before claiming substituted performance is required to give a notice to the other side or to the promisee that they are going and seeking, promiser, they are going and seeking substituted performance, this notice has effectively been seen as a way which sort of reduces the effect of these principles of damage mitigation and foreseeability of damages. So in case of substituted performance, I may effectively go and give notice and recover the actual costs incurred and the expenses that I incur in seeking substituted performance, as opposed to the claim that I would have simply claimed compensation for the non-performance of that contract. So effectively bringing in substituted performance, this is the main change which comes in, and we may likely see that parties now opt for substituted performance, as it will be easier and simpler for them to claim what they have actually incurred and not be bogged down by these principles of reasonability and loss mitigation.
Okay, so coming back to Nilima, I think again this section seems to be the key in a way that you don't have to really choose between specific performance and compensation to start with, but at least there is no break in the contract performance in the chain of the contracts of the project in totality. Mm-hmm. And then worry about the rest, because then you at least have moved on so far as the commercial contracts are concerned. Do you think this is a very important aspect bringing in the balance? Or do you think that this is one another provision which may or may not see too much of action when it comes to real business?
As Ashish rightly pointed out, the remedy has always been there. I would like to refer to illustration F, K, and L of Section 73 of the Contract Act. One illustration says that the contract to carry out repairs of the building has not been done properly. So the entire cost of doing those repairs can be recovered as compensation. So doing means it is not done from somebody and the expense can be claimed. Similarly, another illustration quite clearly says that if a building is done in an unworkmanlike manner and it has been damaged, then the person who owns it can get it rebuilt and can claim the cost of rebuilding plus, of course, his other losses. So the right is there and recognized under Section 73 and often referred to as the cost of cure. To cure what has been broken and then claim that cost. Moreover, many contracts include such type of remedy within the contract. Typically, a government contract may have a provision that if the contractor fails to fulfill his obligations, then the government will get it done through another contractor and can claim the expenses from the main contractor. So the provision was there also in contract. It was also recognized under 73. The main thing is what is new, therefore, in this remedy. Firstly, if the notice for complying with the contract and undoing the breach has been given, If the person who gets the work done is confident or becomes confident that he will be able to get the entire cost and expense of getting it done from the third party, and it will not have to go through the normal tests of Section 73, especially of contemplation and of litigation. So this confidence is what the plaintiff will have. Secondly, it will probably encourage many plaintiffs who would otherwise ask for specific performance, instead of asking for specific performance, to get their promise fulfilled from outside so that their promise is fulfilled, the business is done, and then they can claim the amount. So instead of claiming specific performance, they claim substituted performance. But moreover, you know, the whole idea of this whole amendment is that parties should not be required to go to court. They should settle matters. So it is quite likely that if A has a contract with B and B has broken it because he finds it difficult to fulfill, it is more costly, and A has given a notice of 30 days that he should come and comply, it is quite possible that parties may renegotiate so that, you know, both of them are able to carry out the work on terms which are acceptable to both of them. This, if this happens, then that is the achievement for this section. So the purpose of the section is to give that confidence to the plaintiff, and so to say, compel parties to renegotiate in circumstances where it can be done.
Sure. So taking a little forward and coming back to the Indian scenario, you may have as many laws as you may want in terms of enforcement, in terms of compensation, but the biggest challenge is always the delays. So even if you claim enforcement, maybe it will take several years to do that. Or even if you claim a substitute performance and then the cost, then again you will require several years to recover. So in my view, the trend of injunctions and the fascination of injunctions is not going to go away from an Indian context till the time we put our judicial system a little more robust. So does anything change there? Particularly, is there a difference as to how injunctions were granted for performance of contracts in an immovable property scenario versus a movable property scenario, in case of personal contracts versus case of commercial contracts? Does anything change, or the law of injunctions or the practice of injunctions in India will stay as it is for many more decades till we get the right sense on judicial system?
The law relating to injunction has not changed much under the amendment, except in relation to infrastructure projects. So let me discuss the two things separately. Section 38(2), which speaks about perpetual injunctions, provides that injunctions may be granted by the court in matters relating to contract if it would satisfy the requirements of grant specific performance. Now, applying this provision, even in cases relating to specific enforcement of contracts of immovable property, courts often refused temporary injunctions. Now, why I say temporary injunctions? Because they are granted on the same principles as perpetual injunctions. So they refused injunctions on the ground that this is a contract which will not be specifically enforced, and therefore we will not grant injunctions. So injunction granting is related to capability of its specific enforcement. And now that every contract can be specifically enforced, it becomes so much easier to ask for injunctions. Injunctions, of course, are temporary ones, are always subject to the triple test of irreparable loss, prima facie case, and balance of convenience. I mean, that is for all injunctions, including relating to contracts. Now, the beauty of injunction is that this question of effectiveness of enforcement and the problem of cost and will the court be able to enforce it, that is very much less in injunction. And therefore, even though a contract for personal service cannot be enforced by specific performance, injunction relating to it can still be granted, and that is under Section 42, I think.
The negative covenant.
Okay. And why is that provision there? Because it may not be possible to specifically enforce the contract, but nevertheless, an injunction can be granted for the purposes of enforcing it. So injunctions, therefore, are an easier remedy than specific performance. But when they are asked at a temporary stage, the judge has to grant them on the basis of prima facie case. And that is where the discretion can come. The main aspect of injunction that this amendment has changed is in relation to contracts relating to infrastructure projects. Now, the law has changed on two counts. One part is in the chapter of specific performance, and section 20 capital A has been added to say that where there is a suit involving a contract relating to an infrastructure project, a court will not grant an injunction if the injunction would impediment or delay the progress of that project. Which infrastructure projects will it apply to? These are listed in the schedule which is added to the Act by the amendment. So, if it's a contract relating to infrastructure projects, an injunction will not be granted if it will delay the project. But more importantly, an amendment is made to Section 41, which is the general law relating to injunctions. Section 41 belongs to a chapter of injunctions which applies to contracts, to properties and all other obligations. And Section 41 is about circumstances in which the court will refuse to grant an injunction. Now, the court will refuse to grant an injunction in certain cases to which clause small h a has been added. And again it says that the court will not grant an injunction if it would delay the completion of an infrastructure project. So it is to be now seen that wherever infrastructure projects are involved and they would be delayed, courts will be more willing to refuse injunction.
So I think we have another one or two topics which possibly are more controversial than, you know, what we have already discussed as to whether you can ask for compensation in alternate to specific performance under the new law with the kind of changes it makes, that compensation can only be in addition, not in substitution to specific performance. And then there are remedies under other sections as well. And more importantly, to what kind of matters this law will apply, whether this will apply to contracts entered after October 1 or cause of action arising after October 1 or suits being filed after October 1, arbitrations being invoked after October 1, or it will apply to anything which comes to the adjudication after October 1. So there are quite a few questions around it which are kept open, possibly for lawyers to argue and make a little bit more sense to this law as it goes along. But keeping those couple of points for some other day, may I open the floor for some questions, and then if there is some time, we'll touch upon this topic as well. So can we open the floor for questions now and see if there are any queries or comments or thoughts of the participants of the call?
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, press star and one on the touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. The first question is from the line of Anand Verma from ICICI Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, Anand here. So my question is, if suppose I am a promisee under a particular contract and I have a contract which specifically bars me to have a substituted performance, then in such scenario, can still the court ask me to go for a substituted performance and not grant damages in that case?
Yeah, hi Anand, thanks for your question. So the law gives an exception for such contracts contrary to the law, specifically for, or I would say only for substituted performance of contracts. So if you have agreed anything contrary to this, then that would prevail over the law and you will not get the substituted performance clause available as a matter of right.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Ritesh Jain from Apex Fund Services. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My question is twofold. One starts on the previous question, actually. If I understood correctly, you're saying that it would not apply to old contracts if we have specifically restricted ourselves for specific performance, one. And two, as I understand the, you know, the reason for having this amendment is to reduce litigation. So what would you advise to, you know, ensure that this doesn't go to court, these contracts which we will, going forward, we would be, you know, negotiating with our counterparties. What should we ensure so that, you know, the litigation is reduced and we can get the specific performance only via the contract mechanism itself?
So just to clarify, what Vyapak said was substituted performance in the agreed contract. I mean, you can opt out of substituted performance, not specific performance.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
Yeah, that's what Vitesh could say.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Vitesh. And yeah, so what Simon was saying is what you can opt out is from substituted performance. Can you opt out from the specific performance? Is again a debatable issue which has left open under the law, but that is again something which we can discuss at some point in time.
In
but
the coming committee report, you know, specifically said that such a clause would not be specifically enforced. That means any clause which debarred the right to specific relief would not be specifically enforced.
And that is missing in the law. But coming specifically, Ritesh, to your question as to how do we reduce litigation risk, I think I don't think there is anything which can, you know, take away a right of a party to litigate. And therefore, there is nothing which can reduce it. But what I feel that this law does is that the threat that one can force upon a party to specifically perform, however onerous that contract is or however bad bargain that contract is for the person who has breached the promise, I think that threat in itself would first reduce the breach occurrence itself in my view, and two, even if that breach occurs, I think parties would opt for more amicable settlements before it goes into the court litigation, because no longer a party can say, look, I anyways don't have to perform. In cases of compensation, I'll deal with it because it's not easy to, one, determine the compensation and then to recover it. So I think people were more confident to breach and not perform. In my view, that mindset will very soon change the way the jurisprudence will develop in this new law. More particularly, I think commercial courts, arbitration, and even infrastructure project disputes, everything is now happening in a time-bound manner of 12 months and 18 months and so on and so forth. So that pressure itself will bring in settlements rather than litigations. Because at the end of the 1 year, if you anyways have to perform and also pay compensation, it's better to settle rather than wait for that order to come. So you are definitely going to see a change in the attitude of litigants who have, you know, not specifically performing the contracts, thinking that they don't have to worry about the compensation. And there is an additional point from Nilima as well.
The question is, can or should parties be allowed to choose their remedy or to say that this remedy will not be available in their contract? For example, to have a clause which is parties can specifically enforce, so they have chosen specific performance, or a clause which says parties cannot specifically enforce, where it is restricted. Will these clauses work? Ideally, parties should be able to choose their remedy and the extent to which the remedy will be available. But giving too much power to the parties means that the party which is in a better bargaining power can force remedial restrictions on the party which is, has a weak bargaining power. So there is a balance to be maintained, and we have to see how such clauses will later on be implemented.
On the last statement, I actually wanted to put another question, if I may.
Sure.
Yeah, so is it possible now that we can enter into contracts stating that specific performance will not be enforced or, you know, cannot be asked to be enforced? Because I think it would, won't the contract be void, because now since the act has changed, so it's actually that specific performance has to be enforced, or my understanding is otherwise.
So that's true. Only thing, and that can be a very strong argument, the only defense to this is that you can still contractually opt out, because this is still a matter of remedy and relief rather than a substantive right of contract law, or
it doesn't close all remedies.
And it doesn't close away the remedies. So like you say that I will go for liquidated damages versus a compensation, like you say that compensation is adequate or inadequate in terms of your contract, there is a strong argument to say that unlike the section where the provision of law, if not applicable, makes the contract void, this is a section which allows parties to choose a remedy, and once chosen, court's discretion is taken away. So at the end of the day, it is still a matter of choice, and if two sophisticated parties having the same bargain decides one way or the other, then it may still be something which courts will agree to rather than disagree. But you are right, because as Kimon was saying, there was a provision under the committee report to say explicitly, which has not been taken into account, the provision that contract parties can contract out of substituted performance of contract is missing in specific performance of a contract, and this will obviously throw up on the argument which you rightly said. But in my view, at the end of the day, if two sophisticated parties agree that they don't want a specific performance but they only want compensation, then that it will be so, because that is something that they are choosing as a part of their relief.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. A reminder to the participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star and one at this time. Participants, to ask a question, you may press star and one. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one. There are no further questions in queue.
So, in which case, let me thank again Professor Nilima for giving such a great insight on how this law has developed over a period of time and what we are going to see while we move beyond what legacy gave us in terms of common law. And, of course, thanks Simon and Ashish and every participant who joined today on the call, and hopefully we'll do the second part of this series as well, looking at the issues involved. So please watch out for this space, and hopefully we'll have another occasion to interact. Thank you. And goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call for the day. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.